You're listening to Sovereign Mind Radio, where we explore and expose the nature of the game. Welcome to another relay of Sovereign Mind on Sovereign Mind Radio. It is Thursday, February 18th, 2010. And as always, here we explore the nature of the game, the game players, and the strategies in place that appear to hold us spellbound and distracted. I'm your host, Sonia Barrett. And we will be taking another one of our journeys here, tours with the informed guests who continue to bring insight to the silent side of corporations, spiritual concepts, science, and technology, as well as to examine the manner in which they influence our choices. My guest today is Dr. Nick Bagish, and he is known for his work dealing with HARP. But we're going to be discussing a number of topics that are quite relevant, not just to HARP. So before we get going with Dr. Bagish, I just want to remind you of the upcoming three-part webinar taking place starting this Saturday, Hacking the Mind, Breaking Reality Codes. And to find out more about this webinar, please visit www.spiritinform.com and click on events, and that would be Saturday, February 20th, 27th, and March 6th. The number to call is 1133. And as most of you probably know, I just went through moving. Moving is a challenge, but at the same time, it was a great thing that happened, so I needed to do that. So despite the process, I'm glad that it's over, and I'm glad that I am in the space that I'm in at this time. So that's the good thing. Now, Dr. Nick Bagish serves as Executive Director of the Lay Institute on Technology, Incorporated, a Texas nonprofit corporation. He is also the publisher and co-owner of Earth Pulse Press, Incorporated, an Alaska-based organization. Dr. Bagish is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, the Nick Bagish Sr., and political activist Peggy Bagish. He is well known in Alaska for his own political activities. He was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He has been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Bagish received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Contemporary Medicines in November 1994. He also co-authored with Jeannie Manning the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology. Begich has also authored Earth Rising 1 and 2, both with the late James Roderick. He has published articles in science, politics, and education, and is a well-known lecturer, having presented throughout the United States and in 19 countries. He has been featured as a guest on thousands of radio broadcasts, reporting on his research activities, including new technologies, health, and earth science-related issues. He has also appeared on dozens of television documentaries and other programs throughout the world, including BBC TV, CBC TV, and Telemundo. Again, you are listening to Sovereign Mind on Sovereign Mind Radio. Dr. Nick, I'd like to welcome you back to Sovereign Mind. It's been a while.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to get on and talk to a lot of listeners, and so we're pleased to be with you again today.
Thank you. And, you know, your work, of course, I was exposed to your work through your first book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, some years ago when it came out. But I think what is amazing is at that time, things were crucial, but what was written then and what you've written since then is never more relevant than it is at this time. We are seeing much of this show up or manifest in our reality now. Much of that technology, all of what was said then, is just crescendoed up until this moment and continues to crescendo.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, the things that we said, you know, it's been 15 years since we published our first articles on the HARP project. And after 15 years and a lot of material later, I think we've been proven right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in the very few instances that still have sort of yet to be seen, we've been dead on right. And, you know, we've meticulously researched that subject. Over 350 sources, I think, were used when we finally went to press. Since that time, of course, we published on a number of technologies, continue to follow HARP, and as time has progressed and more has come out, you know, sort of what HARP's about, but more importantly, this whole direction in which technologies have headed over the last couple of decades. Pretty remarkable change.
Oh, pretty remarkable. We're going to talk about the subtlety of it as well. But one of the things that, when I first contacted you, what triggered me was the earthquake in Haiti. Now, when I first saw that, that was my first impression for a number of reasons. And it wasn't just, you know, off the top speculation. It was just, you know, things that just didn't seem to add up, didn't make any sense to me. And that was within a matter of moments of really hearing about it. And then, obviously, even after I called you, after I talked to you that day, there's so many other things that or many other people started to come up with, you know, information in that regard. So I realized I wasn't the only person wondering about this. Now, not to pin you down and obviously have you go, well, you know, this is what happened. But when you look at the fact that, was it the Dominican Republic? Nothing happened there whatsoever, and it seemed to be, you know, very, very targeted. How possible is this for, would you say, for technology, for HARP, or technology like HARP to have done something like this?
Well, actually, it's more realistic than people think. In fact, there's a quote that I used in the book Earth Rising, the Revolution, and it was a DOD news briefing, and it was Secretary of Defense William Cohen, just after a keynote address on a conference on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction and U.S. strategy. And this is back before 9/11. This goes back to April 28, 1997. And he said, and I quote, others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climates, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. And when people think about HARP, think about, you know, can HARP trigger this kind of an event, you know, it's come up a number of times. It shows up in literature like this. And what is known is that earthquakes and many of these seismic events are associated with specific sort of low-frequency waves that actually are measured and you can monitor them. Some think you can actually trigger an event where there's already pent-up energy, say, stored within a fault system, sending in just the right energy in just the right way, almost like tuning in a radio.
Right.
You can create a resonance effect that will then release that natural energy and cause an earthquake to take place or a volcanic eruption. These are the kinds of things that are talked about, not just, esoterically, but actually by mainstream thinkers, including the Secretary of Defense when he was serving in that capacity, and thinking about it from terrorist states. I mean, can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
Very little science we can attribute in terms of high technology to terrorist states, yet here's a technology that apparently is sufficient and unsophisticated enough for many to be able to pick up and utilize this type of technology. HAARP was one example of perhaps a way to deliver on that.
Right. And what makes it even more challenging is the point of defining when a natural disaster happens now and when it's not natural, unless you are savvy enough and have done enough research to start detecting little things that say, no, this isn't natural. And then it obviously can trigger other things to happen because now it throws everything off course.
Right, right. This is pretty important. I mean, the fact that it takes a man-made coherent signal which has a specific beat frequency or frequency that could be measured, and the fact that other governments that are, advancing in this technology would also recognize those signals. It's actually something you could probably monitor much more efficiently than a lot of things, that we worry about in terms of weapons technologies. And yet, like with Haiti, when the Haiti quake occurred, we had, a lot of people starting to come forward and say, hey, this is a man-made event. And perhaps it was. I mean, I hear that every time a major earthquake, hurricane these days,
mm-hmm.
I get a call related to HAARP because some of the things that we said so many years ago about what this technology was about and what was emerging could do exactly that. And as time's gone on and we start to see, significant events, people want to certainly point to that. The problem is there's no independent monitoring. And this
right.
has been a problem at the very, very beginning. And yet governments have taken our concerns seriously, the European Parliament, Russian Duma, and now others, because it's been dead on right in terms of predictability and what we saw coming, not based on anything unusual except for where our science has been headed the last several decades. In fact, even in the mid-70s, we signed an agreement, an international treaty, where we agreed to not use geophysical manipulation, these kinds of things, triggering earthquakes, climate change, volcanic eruptions, tidal waves, that we wouldn't use them as weapons of war. And that treaty was signed by the United States and others. Most people don't even know it exists, but it was sufficient concern being registered in the 1970s to cause governments to sign on to that agreement in advance of some of the nuclear nonproliferation agreements and chemical weapons agreements. This was important enough to sign off very early on. I think it was a recognition that exactly what you said is you trigger one event in one place or you change or alter something in one place, the downstream effect of that is virtually unpredictable. We cannot model the Earth sufficiently. We do not understand its underlying mechanisms well enough to get a complete model of the planet and know what we're going to do.
Exactly.
Down
absolutely. And the fact is that everything ultimately is some sort of, I guess what we would call it, some sort of sound resonance or something. So even when the earthquake has stopped, and I do feel that even what cannot be picked up probably by even their high-tech instruments, it doesn't mean that the rippling effect has stopped, and I think that's the challenge. You don't know what's still going on. It's still
right.
rippling.
Right, and it's the same with weather and climate, in fact, even more readily manipulated by things like HAARP. And HAARP is essentially a field or an array of antenna that create radio frequency energy and focus it in specific ways
that right.
can interact with one of the last things Ben Eastland, the inventor, was looking at was the interaction of this kind of signal with gravitational waves, which he believed were sort of the underlying mechanism for much of the geophysics of the planet, whether we're talking about climate or earthquake generation. And so what he came to is that with 1,600 times less energy than he thought was needed to manipulate weather, as an example, he discovered that you could, in fact, manipulate weather with systems like HARP pretty effectively. And at the same time, sort of what we're learning and what he learned caused him enough concern to say, you know, weather modification should not be entrusted to any one government. In fact, it shouldn't be trusted to secret experimentation, which is so much of what military experiments turn into. It needs to be done, if ever, in the open light of day. And his rationale was exactly, again, what we're talking about. His view was, well, we're learning some things, but what we're also learning is what we don't know. And what we don't know is bigger than what we do know. And weather modification, we need to do it very slowly and very carefully. And his view was, you know, you might solve a rainfall issue in one country but create droughts in 10 others, you know, as an example, just by a manipulation in one place. And it's not just unique to the U.S. The Russians, the Chinese, and other governments have talked about possessing this very same kind of technology and then using it for things like the Olympics.
Right. I was just going to mention that, like China. And you wonder, you know, what kind of effect did that have? And I know many people say, well, you know, so they made, you know, the sun come out. But then when you look at it, we don't know what that caused, how that affected anything if the sun wasn't supposed to come out and the clouds didn't need to be dried out.
Well, and the old methods were chemical seeding, this kind of thing, where you actually added chemical constituents to cause rainfall. Today,
is that cloud seeding or
And that's the older technology that was used in Vietnam and in that era. We heard public reports of this, but what we're talking about here are essentially energy interactions that cause then these various kinds of events, and we're talking about HARP, which was so unique about HARP, is here's this field of antennas, this array, that literally is like a component on the ground that plugs into the machine of the Earth and causes things to happen. And it uses the energy within the ionosphere in some instances, within the magnetic field lines that surround the Earth in other instances. But just thinking about that sort of shift, we used to think about weapons as bullets and bombs and things that tore tissue. Here we've got a technology that can be used and to manipulate the very essence of the environment. And so that becomes different, you know, in terms of how we look at warfare. You start to think about some of the other technologies advanced in information technologies, in the biosciences and life sciences, information processing, all the sciences and the speed of advancement over the last several decades is phenomenal. Since the 1980s, technology doubled about every 5 years, and then it sped up by the end of the last decade. It was like every 9 months, technology was doubling. And that's everything from the invention field to where we are right now. Just to keep up with that, and that's been the challenge. Your media certainly can't do it. There's very little technical or science reporting if you think about mainstream media.
Oh, no.
Very little. You know, and very little knowledge in the political bodies as well in terms of science. Most of them come from, different law backgrounds or civil service backgrounds, other kinds of backgrounds that really don't speak to high technology and what it's doing in this century.
But, you know, at this point, here is how this also spirals, because now we've got this huge thing about climate change. And, you know, so nobody knows really everybody's just guessing who's really affecting this climate change. I mean, yes, we know there's a natural process that occurs, but now it's so infiltrated by, you know, not only, well, technology and as well as, you know, the corporations and all these other aspects of it, the chemical aspects and all those things, that, it makes it very, very kind of challenging to figure out, you know, where it's coming from. And nobody's really, you're not getting the truth anyway. It's all so distorted, completely
right.
distorted.
Right. You know, in terms of the natural phenomena, you know, there is certainly our natural cycles. And,
right.
And I think we're, you know, well into those all the time. You know, and it's
mm-hmm.
and that contributes probably the greatest amount to climate change.
Right.
When you start to look at these kinds of technologies that are more not so much creating a trend that, you know, covers the planet for years to come, but is specific event oriented, that's a pretty amazing step. The longer questions of climate change and sort of what has man contributed to that, and I'm a bit of a contrarian on this because in terms of greenhouse gases, man only contributes 1-3% of all greenhouse gases. The rest are naturally discharged in the environment. You know, and I don't really worry so much about the debate. You know, people get all tangled up in the debate because they want to, you know, point the blame to nature rather man or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And blame is not really relevant at the moment. I think if we start to look at, as a practical matter, the effect of climate change in terms of alteration of jet streams, you see the effect of that when you get these kinds of winter storms showing up in the East Coast, where it really shouldn't be so severe.
Yeah,
but all that's related to just general shifts. You get temperatures in the oceans change, jet streams change, deposition of snowfall, rainfall, drought areas. All that changes. Now, the aggregate, you know, on the planet as they measure temperature has been a general trend in warming. I don't think anyone can really dispute it, but
right.
what it does is create the kind of disruption that we're seeing. And then you throw on it, technologies allow us to do exactly that, create these kinds of anomalous or bizarre events. So when you start to have them, you know, the question is, you know, was it man-made or
exactly, exactly. And instead of allowing the natural process that, you know, would occur, because yes, as you said, there is a natural cycle. We're in these cycles all the time. So, the planet is doing what it needs to do. But when you throw in this technology aspect of it, then it creates, you know, a little bit of distortion. Now, and more than anything else, I think it's the fear and the money that's generated from this, the fear. More than anything that's generated from it. People are running around in circles as soon as we hear, okay, well, now you need to go to get away from plastic. You need to go to whatever those bags are, the cloth bags or whatever the bags are.
Right.
Environmentally safe. My point is this, that people end up having to jump as soon as they're told, okay, do this thing. Okay, well, maybe that's not a good thing. Okay, now jump over here. So people are jumping around. The majority has no clue. They do no research.
Right.
So they just jump every time they're told to do something, and then it becomes just another money-making venture for somebody. That's what I'm talking about with that
yep.
kind of manipulation.
Well, with the when you look at sort of how government actually functions today, and it's pretty disappointing. I mean, my family's been in it a few generations. You know, my
right.
dad was the U.S. Congress. My
right.
brother now is in the U.S. Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And having traveled back, you know, to visit with him a little bit and just
mm-hmm.
sort of look at that the whole system. And you know, 25, 30 years between. You know, active participation at that level of government, and I can tell you it's changed also. And what's left of the government is really a government by special interests, for special interests, and in their own interest, because what we've ended up with is a kind of policy that's driven by who can afford the ground team. And in terms
right.
of lobbyists and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, you really, in order to influence Congress, what it takes and what it requires and the amount of resources it requires has changed it so dramatically. And yet, the kind of legislation that makes it through doesn't create a fabric of public policy. It creates a patchwork quilt that looks
mm-hmm.
like rags. And when you look at the national policy, that's exactly what we've got. And I think that's what makes people so angry right now. It's not just about health care. It's not about the economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about the fragmentation of our government and the lack of cohesion in a public policy that's good for us.
It's not about what's good for you. That's the sad part. It's not about what's good for you. I mean, and of course, yeah, we won't go down that road in terms of why they would, the powers that be anyway, utilizing HARP to attack certain areas like earthquakes and, you know, where millions or thousands of people die, and that becomes even more than politics. So as I always say, that's a whole other show. And I think there's so many people that can't imagine. I know people that think we're crazy saying that because they can't imagine that another human being could think in such a cruel manner. But I think they're right, you know, that this is something that is necessary. That's the difference.
I don't think anyone really, very few people are truly evil in my experience.
And mm-hmm.
What I've seen is, you know, people thinking they're doing good and end up doing bad. You know, I mean, you can
that's true, though. But that's what I'm saying. They really, whoever's doing whatever, they really think that they're doing it for a good reason.
Yeah, but you know, you can look at the last administration wanted to abandon the treaty we had referenced earlier, you know, dealing with geofiscal manipulation.
And right.
The reason, you know, it came up when Rumsfeld and Cheney were in their heyday. They were talking about abandonment of this treaty, and they were talking about it because the technology has changed so much. So, I mean, mm-hmm. think about if you wanted to wage a covert war, what a better way than to manipulate, say, the weather in North Korea so they had a drought for 10 years.
Oh, yes.
You know, as an example. I mean, and that's a pretty real example. You know, was that natural? Was that man-made? Who the heck knows? And
right.
That's the problem, is you can ask that question. And this is what got the last administration so excited about this technology for very different reasons than, say, a liberal administration. From the standpoint, both, I think, are a little bit more fascinated with sort of the gadgetry of all of this than they ought to be. In fact, it was Zbigniew Brzezinski, back when he wrote the book Between Two Ages, he talked about this very technology that we're speaking about today. And what he said is, no matter who was in power, liberal or conservative, the temptation to use technology to further political ends would
mm-hmm.
be rationalized in all different ways. And not because someone thinks they're evil, but because they really believe in what they're...
They really believe in their cause.
Yeah.
So that's exactly the point I wanted to make. Absolutely. They believe in their cause. So that's the reason why it's not a sense of we're going to do this. This is an evil thing to do. We think we need to do this. This is something that's important. And there's a question that she just slipped my mind. There's something I wanted to. Oh, and then the other aspect of HARP. Let's go to the possibility of affecting the human mind, the human mood, the human brain waves, all of those things, an entire population, an entire group of people, mass amounts of people, can be regulated.
Right. This is an important issue as well. In fact, we cover it in a book called Controlling the Human Mind, which was a last book that I wrote, and it
mm-hmm.
deals with these kinds of technologies and speaking about HARP and sort of what it does. And then there was an excellent article, and it appeared in the U.S. Army College Quarterly Perimeters back in, I think it was 1998, but it was an excellent article that sort of laid out you know, sort of what was going on. Actually, it was originally published in Orienteer, which is a Russian military journal later published by U.S. Army War College. One of the things they said, and I'll quote, it said, in talking about mind control, it says, a psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, incandescent lamps. The signal would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal, unquote. Now, what they were talking about, and when you think about HARP on a massive scale, one of the things that HARP can do is it can be pulse modulated. In other words, think about it like a hammer of energy punching an area above the Earth called the ionosphere. It's about 30 miles up. And by By punching that energy in, it causes the ionosphere to vibrate at a very specific frequency, and it changes because it's an electrically charged, powerfully charged area above the Earth. And what happens then is it creates a long wavelength, an ELF, that passes through the Earth and sea, and it happens that ELF signals are also those that correlate to most of our waking state and sleeping state brain functions. In fact, there's a phenomenon that's called frequency following response, which is where the brain locks on to specific signals that can come in through the optic nerves, through flickering light, mm-hmm. or through the ears, through bioral beat, or can come in through an electromagnetic pulse or a pulsation of energy, or through an ELF entrainment. And what happens is your brain locks onto this external signal, begins to mirror it, and it changes the emotional state. In fact, J.F. Gordon MacDonald was a geophysicist at UCLA. It was also he was a science advisor to President Johnson. One of the things he said is that if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, we could return a signal to the Earth that would disrupt the emotional states of the majority of people in contact with that signal over a hemisphere, huge areas. HARP was the first radio transmitter that allowed us to focus radio frequency energy in the way that HARP does, and actually can create that effect as either a side effect or a deliberate effect of the operating system. And that's extremely important when we start to think about, again, technologies of today. You know, where do they lead us?
Right.
And, you know, this work goes back, the first work in, you know, mind effects that got a lot of prominence actually started in the 1930s at Harvard University in the hypnotherapy labs, and advanced significantly in the 1950s after we had returning prisoners of war from the Korean conflict that were what we call brainwashed. In fact, the term got was born then in the 1950s. And by the time we hit this century, the technologies had changed to where, as the Orienteer and the U.S. Army College Quarterly talks about it, from the standpoint of energy that can create these effects. In fact, there's a great article, and was put out by Technology Horizons by the Air Force Research Lab, and it was on what they called controlled effects, which are the ability to override any of the five senses, whether it be the sense of taste, touch, smell, sight, sound, in such a way as to create complete illusions or holograms of reality that you could not distinguish from reality. In other words, create the override of those systems within the human mind in such a way as to fool it. That's a pretty startling technology.
Yes.
The Air Force advancing in that direction, from our perspective, is causing great concern.
Wow. Now, okay, I have a couple of questions in here, but if something like that were to occur, which I'm sure it's been tested a number of times, what would you say? How can one be in a better state of preparation to override these signals or override any of this? What would your suggestion be? Because we're up against technology, and I think the people with a lack of knowledge are always more susceptible to to whatever it is that's being imposed.
I think that's true. And in this case, weak systems. You tend to, the stronger signal is what you tend to lock into. So
mm-hmm.
whatever it's close to, in close proximity to you. The other thing is that's clear in the literature as well, is that these are big systems. We're talking about systems like HARP. They don't affect everyone. They don't expect them to.
And right.
So that's an interesting consideration, because they don't expect them to, because the research says they don't. And I think strong systems are what builds resistance to these very subtle signals.
Absolutely.
And they can be brought through any mm-hmm. Electromagnetic carrier, whether, like the article said, it could be your power supply system,
mm-hmm.
radio, TV networks. So when you think about sort of technology, I mean, we're immersed in it. If you consider just electromagnetic energy, radio frequency energy as an example, a little over 100 years ago, before the invention of man-made radio, we had background radiation. Today, we have 200 million times more radio frequency energy surrounding each and every one of us from what we've added to the system. So you can think about, you know, pollutants and greenhouse gases and all these things, but when you want to really quantify something as being a big change, that's it. The amount of the amount and way in which we handle energy and what we've learned about it. And in fact, as we've kind of gotten away from the chemical models of the human body and sort of how the body works, we've discovered that underlying that are energy interactions that then create chemical reactions that then are measurable more readily with instruments than the underlying subtle energy exchanges that really drive living systems. And so when you talk about these kinds of in what I call invasive technologies as they advance, without consideration to that, I think we're in for the exact kind of problems that we're seeing
right.
in industrialized cultures and societies, high cancer rates, stress-related illnesses of all kinds. If you go into an area that immediately experiences a power failure, and we all live in country, part of the country, I'm sure everywhere now, we have these total power failures. And what most people immediately notice is how quiet it is. But secondarily, it's almost like your whole body exhales. It's like your whole body finally quit compensating for these external fields. And that creates sort of a perpetual state of stress that most of us aren't even aware of. And
right.
when you add in fear, which is a big disruptor, because so much of what we're experiencing in just the reality of existing in this world today generates fear, and so much of it's directed to generate fear. And as soon as you do, if you look at brainwave activity, it's the easiest mind control of all, because
right.
you cannot reach your higher states of consciousness in a state of fear. And I think that's, so when we talk about educating the public on these, we're talking about some pretty radical technologies. In the books we've published, 1,600 sources support, you know, what we're saying. And in all of this, fear is clearly...
It's the height. That's the highlight. That's the biggie.
Yeah, that's the adversary in all of it. Because if you can shake that, you can maintain your sort of individual coherence and your ability to be aware and conscious and function as a human being is intended to. And I think that's something that the same technologies that we're talking about and sort of the bad news is also the other side of that is the good news, because we're also learning a lot about what the human being and what our intellect is and beyond our intellect, what other capacities we might have. And I think that realization perhaps is the benefit of all of this. You know,
right.
I mean,
it's propelling you towards that.
Yeah, and I think there's always that side of it. And I think this whole chase and discovery, in fact, I think the biggest thing that early researchers for government looking for sort of the nefarious applications of mind control technologies, one of the things they discovered early on are these anomalous human capabilities, things they can't explain that are sort of beyond the calculable. And yet, at the same time, the realization that, wow, you know, if everybody reached these higher states of consciousness, you know, government wouldn't be so effective at manipulating
control yourself. Wouldn't right absolutely, there would be nobody to control, which, you know, again, that's scary for people who are here on a mission of controlling. Some people are just designed that way. It's just whole journey in life is to control.
And it's a, you know, and it is a you know, you see that in, you know, everywhere, I guess, but ultimately, where I guess I remain optimistic on all the technologies is I think that ultimately human beings will evolve in a way that is gives us greater capacities, and at the same time strip away some of the illusion that's being sent to us.
Oh,
and, you know, and on all levels, you see it. You know, you see it, a lot of. Sometimes you need the drama of all the tension in the world in order to get people to start to focus on things that are truly important. And it's sad, but I think this nature of human beings.
It's the chaos rule.
it's
the chaos rule. I mean, certainly I see it even for myself, asking a few questions, you know, as a child. Some of us come in I think, in this life, in that manner where you're questioning everything from the minute you are conscious of your own existence here, right through. And so for people like myself or yourself or many other people I've had on the show, it's that questioning and everything you're discovering continues to propel you to want to discover more, which is what you're saying. And it allows that expansion. It allows you to shift into those higher levels of consciousness if you don't stop off and hang out in fear.
I think that's true. I think that's very true. And I think we do it on, maybe not even related to these subjects, but other things.
Right.
Within our lives. And again, when we start to think about what is, what are we going to evolve our governments into in this century? Think about it. If it really does spring from the people and by the people, and we believe in that, and I think most of us do believe in that,
mm-hmm.
How do we get that back?
In the
advent of where our technologies go? Because high technology is what makes governments also powerful
mm-hmm.
in the 21st century. And
oh, yeah.
To not guide that by a larger public ethic, we're in trouble. And when you think about military planners, so much has gone into these kinds of projects by military planners who will point to you and I and say, oh, they're paranoid or they're afraid or they're fearful. But when you think about it, that's the military's job. Because what they actually do is they paint the worst scenarios, every one of them they can think of,
mm-hmm.
and then design a program to counter them. That's their job. Well, that's what they do. And they spend a lot of money on a lot of experts outside of their agencies to come in and kind of give them future possible scenarios. And then they go back and sort of plan around that.
Strategize.
And,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. And billions of tax dollars and mm-hmm. billions of private money is pushed into that effort. Most of it we never get to see. And the Congress doesn't even get to take notes. And most of the Congress, when you look at those technology and science committees, they don't have scientists or technology-oriented industrialists even on those closed committee hearings to question whatever they're being told. And so, and I think that's a problem because as technologies advance and they become more and more powerful to do the kinds of things that we're talking about today, the scrutiny on that technology and the restrictions on that technology and the penalties for abusing it should be in line with the 21st century, and they're not. And that's when we talk about all of these technologies, the public sort of gets left behind as lobbyists push forward for funding and research without much consideration to what maybe is in the more public good.
Right, absolutely. And I think, yes, there is, as we said, the fear that is pushed. But then what I also notice is that there are people who are also afraid to know.
that's very true. Yeah, I think that's very true. And I mean, it's... the media is so pervasive now in terms of what vehicles are out there and what people go to for media is so fluid right now that there's a lot of change, I think, in the wind. On the one hand, it used to be three networks, and that was the extent of our news. And today we have lots of alternatives. I mean, this program we're on today, as an example. And that's I think that's changing the dynamic a bit. At the same time, there's tension, a lot of tension.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to be refocused in a different direction, I think.
Absolutely.
And, the fear-driven and corporate-driven policies, I think that's the realization of even Obama, if you watch him in the last few
mm-hmm.
weeks, the realization that you can't change anything until the system changes.
Right.
It's a systemically rotten, and that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
That I care what you're trying to get through, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, it doesn't matter because the gridlock is so severe that the only ones pushing anything through are those that are paying. And that's
right.
The problem. And that is a very real state of American politics and global politics for that matter. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's just as difficult to move legislation in Europe as it is to move legislation in the U.S. Maybe it's even a little easier in Europe these days, actually, when I think about it, because
mm-hmm.
people know what it's like to be oppressed in their living memories.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, we don't really have that because it's come in on the installment plan. and it really has. It's like the frog in the pot, you know, you boil up slow and you don't even know your water's boiling in your bed.
Gradual, absolutely. That's why a lot of it, which that was sort of one of my other questions, too, is the gradualism of many of these things. When you go back maybe, 20, even just 20 years ago, if we were to really go back and look at that time, that moment, we can more clearly see, scratch our heads and go, wait a second, whoa, when did all this happen? But you don't really see it happening. Most people don't. You just kind of flow into it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And at the same time, it's a there's deliberate efforts to change the public's general perception about things. I'll tell you a good example is there's a document, again, U.S. Army War College, called The Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflicts Short of War. And it was this paper that was done to sort of say, hey, we're advancing all these new technologies. This is the late 80s, early 90s when it was published. And these technologies fly in the face of the Constitution. And so... Mm-hmm. There was, you know, this, and they were things like being able to knock out an aircraft's electronics remotely without leaving any residual damage. So the plane would crash, you know, they'd check it out, and they'd say, up, pilot error. You know, these kinds of technologies.
Right.
They discussed in the paper, and what they said is, you know, they violate the Constitution. And then they went into this debate over where the Constitution applied. You know, was it only on U.S. soil, or was it, you know, where your servicemen and women went? You know, did the Constitution travel with them, or did they leave it at the door? and that debate actually was there. You know, I was pretty amazed by that. And yet you see the last administration actually play that out. I mean, they put the Constitution at the doorstep.
Absolutely.
And around the world and, you know, did all kinds of things.
We'll just set this down over here for a while. We'll just set it aside.
Yeah, and then the other part of that same paper, it said to get these new technologies that would fly in the face of the Constitution to where the public would accept them, what we needed was an environment of fear. And this paper actually then expressed two ways to get there. One was through amplifying the worries about international drug trafficking, and the other was international terrorism.
Right.
If you look at both of those issues since the late 80s to today, and the amount of fear surrounding those issues, and what has that led us to? You know, it's obvious that was a workable plan.
Mm-hmm.
And fear does that. You know, fear over time erodes our sensibilities and what we think we're exchanging for security. In fact, we're not going to have security, and we're not going to have liberty either. And people forget this over time, and yet you look at the last 20, 30 years, and how the attitudes have changed. You're now getting X-ray strip shirts.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's okay. I mean, I love those people that they interview. You know, they probably get 10 people who say no, but they pick 2 that oppose it and pick 10 who say, oh, yeah, we think it's great, you know, as long as it's for our protection. It's just...
Yeah. And, you know, we actually wrote about this technology, Jim Roderick and I, in Earth Rising the Revolution.
Oh, okay.
Too. And we got into this back 7-8 years ago when the first technologies were starting to advance in this area. And we raised the very questions that are being raised now by CNN, you know, 7 years later. And
right. The
thing about all these technologies is you can see, I mean, you've not seen anything yet. I mean, the things that are being talked about in the open literature that probably are 5-10 years, maybe in some instances much less, away from implementation. The technologies to actually look at brain activity.
Right, the emotional assessment, yes.
Yeah. And you think about airports. Huh? A lot of people fear flying, so they're going to have a profile. You know?
Oh, yeah, everybody, practically.
Yeah, and if you look at, you know, you just look at what's going on in terms of airport security and sort of those steps along the way, first erosions of where people say, okay, it's okay to take your shoes off, it's okay to...
Exactly.
It's okay for someone to look into my head and see what I'm thinking because I don't have a safe flight. And, you know, in the price of democracy, is a certain amount of exposure. The price of freedom in a republic is a certain amount of exposure. And finding what that line is has become increasingly more difficult as technology advances. At the same time, our vulnerabilities, by our very dependence on the technology create a whole other chain of events. In fact, we're just starting to hear about this in mainstream as the idea of information warfare. We're not talking about propaganda here. We're talking about getting through the networks that connect and run our power grids, our radios, our TVs, our cable networks, you know, virtually our bank accounts, everything that we depend on. At the same time, very vulnerable to attack. You know, you talk about the kinds of wars that will be fought in future decades. Shutting down someone's infrastructure or shutting down their financial structure could be as devastating or more devastating than precision nuclear weapons.
How about shutting you down? As the human system. I mean,
right.
You know, that's definitely a huge possibility. I mean, there's so many things that are being discovered in terms of the brain and DNA, and there's a show, I'm not sure if you're familiar, I've brought this up a number of times, but Dollhouse. I thought Dollhouse was a fascinating, fascinating show, and I couldn't figure out why they canceled it. Well, I sort of can't, actually. But they focused on, and it seemed like they might have taken a lot of the story from the Kathy O'Brien story, Transformation of America. Are you familiar with Dollhouse?
Yeah. You know, the thing about all of this, you know, when you start to look at what is possible, the idea of being able to manipulate behavior has been around for a long time. It's gotten better and better. I think we're already
there.
Already there. The big thing is mass delivery systems and who's going to make that decision. And that's, I guess that's again why, as we focus on this issue and bring it forward, and what we've done essentially is compile the literature. And HARP is a trigger for all this because it popped out in the HARP research years ago. But this area of technology and really speaks to where are we headed, you know?
I mean,
if we continue down this path, we're going to be in a very directed and controlled society. At the same time, if we look at technology, you know, if we can keep up with the fair and regulation in line with you know, what we are as human beings and direct some of that research in a little bit different direction, because what's being discovered about the mind and brain and the body, to degrade it, it also has a great deal to do with enhancing our potentials and performance. And this
right.
is where I think we're really missing the boat is, you know, methods for brain entrainment, for instance, for reaching a disturbed state by some government nefarious interest, you know, whether you're an Iraqi sitting in the trench having something directed at you to create fear and anxiety, which actually Scottish media said occurred in the first Gulf conflict, which is why we saw military, you know, they collapsed like a bunch of kids.
Basically turned themselves in.
Yeah, I mean, it was like panic.
Yeah.
And you don't see that in organized militaries. And so, you know, when you start to look at that sort of use of the technology, people say, well, you know, it can be rationalized with what the lies that say. But at the same time, we had the last Secretary of the Air Force under Bush made the comment that we're test all these what would be considered, and that would be considered non-lethal weapons on Americans first before we deploy them in the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then we need a little wider discussion. You know, the last time, the times in the history of this country when they did experiments on Americans, usually it was without our permission and resulted in some pretty horrendous things that never actually got prosecuted, and here we're talking about exactly that. In fact, Secretary of Energy O'Leary said 500,000 Americans have been victims of human experiments over a 40-year period without their consent. This included everything from some of the things we're talking about today to some of the more bizarre that we've read about in the media over the years.
Right, and this kind of, you know, when I mentioned Dollhouse, of course, and the imprinting and the, basically the removal of who one is and storing it on a chip or putting it in someone else, changing who you are to someone else.
Right.
Now this brings in this transhumanism and this the whole post-human and, you know, the man-merger machine. And it doesn't really seem like it until you look at it and you realize this is all meshing together. It's all merging together in that sense. It's taking us, you know, through that journey of possibility of not being sure what defines consciousness, what defines a human being. You know, now you have all of these things. You know,
right.
What would you say about that?
It's getting more and more, as we get into a smaller and smaller capacity, in other words, we get the technologies of nanotechnologies and information and biosciences continue to merge and coalesce, you're able to get much, much more powerful systems. In fact, quantum computing is probably not too far down the road. At the same time, what is a quantum computer? I mean, let's describe that for just a second. If we had a quantum computer, what would it do? If we took the biggest computer on the planet today, the supercomputers that we read about, they do 280 teraflops a second, which is equal to 6.6 billion people with hand calculators every 5 seconds doing a calculation for 60 hours. And that computer, the supercomputer of today, will do all of that in 1 second. That's pretty powerful.
Pretty dang powerful.
Now imagine that supercomputer not running for that 1 second, but running for a trillion years.
Mm-hmm.
And a quantum computer will do the same thing in 1 hour. Mm. Now, that just, what could you do with that? You know, well, you could do a lot of things. This is one of the races to technology, because at that point, every encryption system in the world is instantly obsolete.
That
volume of computing power allows
it's over.
Everything. So whoever wins that race can decide whether they want to shut the whole system down and, you know, in a pretty chaotic way or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's where quantum computing moves forward. Now, the thing to consider is the brain that's between our ears is the best guess of anyone is it's probably got that same quantum computing.
It does. I believe that.
Yep, and so here we are with billions and billions of quantum computers already functioning that just don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So really, when you talk about mind technologies, and this was the big breakthrough for government and the thing that scared them the most, was if the population, even a very small percentage, were able to utilize that capacity, it would change everything about everything. And I think that's maybe the bigger realization. So when you think about sort of the bad side of this stuff is when you develop technologies and you develop science and you start to recognize certain realities about what human beings are and what we can do, depending on your personal state of being, you might be pretty fearful of that. And that's what I think is driving so much of the technologies today is the fear that whoever gets there first, and it could be through the vehicle of a human being, and that's exactly what will happen. And so I think when we talk about technology, the backdrop is what humans have innately probably already takes us there. And technology is a way we reflect sort of this aspect of ourselves. And unfortunately, the big science, the science that really can be transforming, is being used in a wrong way, particularly in the life sciences. Because as we learn about the brain and the mind and the capacity of human beings in government labs, they shut that information down. They don't make that readily available.
This is what I wanted to bring up. I'm glad that you brought up about the quantum computers and all of that, because I think we need to look at the bigger picture. But I am looking at this not from the perspective of fear, which is something that I'm always talking about on the show, but I think in terms of really looking at what's truly going on instead of burying our heads in the sand. And I think coming to a place of looking at the human design, how are we designed? And these bodies are computers. Technically, I mean, you know, when you really look at how they're designed, obviously on a much grander level, but looking at that and seeing the way these other folks are thinking, this is why they're thinking it's okay, though, to do either the merger, the man merger, part man, part computer. And these are real conferences that take place with real scientists that are saying, this is what we're going to do. And they have a name for that new species. And I don't know if you saw this, Dr. Nick, but this was the Immortality Conference where they were talking about laws, that it was essential to start creating laws to protect this new species coming from robots, these new species that would become a part of our society.
Well, and the real question is what is consciousness? And
right.
Can you create it in this way? And that's a question that that blurs religion and science in a pretty dramatic way. I don't think science really has the full picture on this one.
Oh, really?
And I think this is...
What made you say that?
Well, you know, when you look at all of it, science is always the kindergartner with the hand grenade, you know? I mean, we never really get past that. We just learn more and we get more dangerous. And I think in terms of some of the interesting parts of this, though, is, you look at traumatic brain injuries as an example. Where you have a certain part of the brain that's been disabled, can we rebuild it, with microcircuits? And the answer is going to be yes. In fact, some of this has already been done with primates. The merging of brain cells on electronic substrates has already been done. The growing of brain cells in the lab, the growing of neural connections between those cells has been done.
It's being done, basically.
And so the base research is complete. It's a question of, where does consciousness come in and where does it reside? And I think we're going to discover more about that as that research advances, because you can regulate here and then somewhere else the research continues. And, you can't regulate everywhere. It just doesn't really work that way. And what's going to happen, in my estimation, is the technologies will continue to advance either in the open light of day or not.
Right.
And how they get applied will determine a great deal about our futures. And I think the awareness of these technologies is changing. I think people are becoming more educated, and even in the most advanced psychology coursework, people understand frequency following response. They understand the ways in which the brain can be driven. All of that understanding is also leading to these same questions as what's ethical. Even the publication, The Economist, back in 2002, ran a cover story on mind control. In fact, that was what the cover said. And it was on the ethics. What do you do with this technology? The idea of creating a body of law for something that we don't even know whether it will possess consciousness or not, maybe is a little premature. When we consider what laws don't exist on the books, for protecting those of us that absolutely have consciousness today, and that's what's lacking. And the idea of continuing to see experimentation in these areas without fully informed consent, without more public scrutiny, I think is a mistake, and one that history will turn back and look at and say was indeed a mistake, because the temptation is too great. Think about even private side applications. Outside of government. A good example is they developed technology using silent subliminals, which are below the threshold of human hearing,
right,
that are used in Japan in department stores, and they broadcast in 7 languages statements to dissuade shoplifters. And what they found is a decrease in shoplifting by 40%. Now, people say, well, that's 40% less. That's a proven technology. What happened to the other 60%? Well, most shoplifting actually is done by professional bands or individuals that have suspended consciousness. They're not even listening to their own voice saying, hey, don't do this, much less 7 other languages telling them the same thing. They're not listening, and so, or they're ignoring the message. But again, now what if they wanted, instead of dissuading shoplifters, and people say, well, that's a good thing, I'll accept that. Well, what about selling you the fluorescent green socks with the orange polka dots on aisle 6 that I'm moving? And all of a sudden, sales of those go up for the wrong reasons. See, this is why again, we start to look at, you know, what is a permissible use, we really need to ask the bigger question is, should it be used at all? And if so, under what conditions and circumstances, and how do you get to the point of informed consent, especially when you're talking about penetrating your awareness, your consciousness, the thing that gets you from point A to point B. And we could argue we already do that, you know, with
Matt. Right.
And I would say, yeah, we do. But at least we have a fighting chance.
Mm-hmm.
We perceive the words and understand the arguments and have a chance to rationally debate them. You take that out of the equation by any means, and I think it's a fundamental violation of everything that certainly our founders in this country could envision. In fact, if the technology had existed then, they would have outlawed it.
Right. Absolutely.
Never move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, again, I bring these things up because there's so much that what we talk about and what you talk about with other people, it doesn't even scratch the surface as to what's going on, as you said earlier, that we don't know, so we don't know about.
Well, if you go back, you were asking me about this idea of being able to suspend someone's awareness and give them a new personality. The work that started that goes back to a guy named Estabrooks back in the 1920s, working at Harvard's hypnotherapy labs. And in the 30s, he had perfected a system where he could take one out of every five people that had a propensity for hypnosis, and they could take them down so deep over a 9-10 month period, they could create a whole new personality. And what they were trying to create was a super spy, someone that they could then launch out into society that would have no recollection of their former self until they were brought back into that hypnotic state and that former self acknowledged again. But, you know, in what he did over, from the 30s until at least the late 70s, or the 70s when he was still talking about this technology, he achieved it. He found that he could do this. Well, you know, you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Once you split a personality at that level, how do you reconstruct that? And I don't think you do. And this is where, you know, this kind of experimentation got pretty insidious. In fact, right. Estabrooks even went so far in the early 60s. One of the last books he published talked about the use of LSD for creating various effects that were of use in this line of research. And
right, they talked about it on Fringe. Mm-hmm. Well, they showed that on Fringe, actually. So you have a couple of shows that are, you know, if somebody's really paying attention, I mean, those are shows that I do watch. Fringe is very cutting edge, and it does go into a lot of this stuff. They've done a lot of work. A couple weeks ago, they had one segment that was dedicated to, what's his name? It was during the time of Hitler, and how they were able to create a formula to, based on various things, whether it be eye color, people with blue eyes, or people with green eyes, or whatever the case may be, that would eliminate all people with either, you know, blue eyes or brown hair or various things.
Right, so, right. It's just the genetic engineering of essentially weaponizing your genetics.
Right.
The issue of affecting the brain and mind go way back, and you know what has happened is that technologies have advanced and better systems have evolved, and now we're seeing a lot more discussion about. I think the reason we're seeing more discussion too is at some level people go, you know, we really need to do something in this realm that's a little more constructive, because as soon as policymakers recognize it, we took this into the European Parliament back in the 90s, and they actually passed a resolution in 1999 where they opposed the use of technology that would affect the human brain. And what they said, and it was in their resolution A4-0005/99, and it called for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings. And this, right preceding that section, are the three sections that dealt with the HARP system. Based on our testimony there on these areas, these sections made it into their resolution. And, you know, what we had shown them was exactly what you could do with a technology that allows you to transfer sound through the nervous system where you can hear my voice in your head.
Right.
That's been done wirelessly through acoustic heterodyning by a guy named Woody Norris, who won the Lemelson Prize in 2000, I think it was 2005 at MIT for demonstrating that possibility. But the book, Controlling the Human Mind, the Technologies of Political Control or Tools for Peak Performance, really got into this issue and starts with a discussion of HARP, and then it gets into the history of all of these technologies as they evolved. Over three dozen U.S. patents are cited showing different ways to control and manipulate behaviors. And then, you know, we sort of transition into, you know, sort of the other side of the equation. What can we do to enhance human performance in a way that maybe is ultimately the counter to bad policy, as a smart, conscious human being that's fully able to utilize their capacities? I think ultimately that's what it's about. That's why we're on the planet. Fear-based systems that we've allowed to evolve are what need to crumble away. And in the midst of the fear that people are in today, whether they're worrying about their insurance or their jobs or their economy or these wars, or the natural disasters that fall from time to time and place to place, letting go of the fear and starting to move forward is so easily said and so difficult to do, and yet is, in fact, the challenge, I think, of this
generation. It is the key. It is absolutely the key. Absolutely. And we've seen it on Star Trek. You know, way back when you watch Star Trek and some of the situations they would get into, they had to either, you know, eliminate the fear because they realized it was the fear that would hold them in certain situations. It was, you know, technology that was another planet in Star Trek. And so they would have to let go of that. And when they did, things would either move for them, happen for them. So, you know, we've seen many of these sci-fi films that have indicated this.
Well, if you look at brain activity under an EEG, you can clearly see fear creates incoherent brain patterns, the kind that don't lend themselves to higher-ordered thinking or higher states of awareness.
But it agitates the entire form. I mean, you're in, the fight-or-flight mode all the time.
Right. Right, and as soon as you get past that, you start to actually slow the brain rhythms down. You move past the beta states into this awake alpha state of awareness. This is where you are when you're in that sort of zone of creativity, or when you're an athlete and you're in that zone of just that space. You know, and all of us know it when we get there, and we get there from time to time.
Right.
This is where we should normally be. You know, little kids, they're even in a slower state. Little kids between 3 and 6 are running a lot of theta, which is where you and I are between awake and asleep, when we're consciously aware of our dreams, what we're sort of participating in them at the same time.
Right.
This is where little kids live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why they have difficulty figuring out what's make-believe and what's real, because they're kind of going in and out of that state of awareness. In a different rhythm than we are. But at the same time, look what they're learning at that age. You know, they learn language like a sponge. They develop concepts, self-awareness, all these things. And then we slow down as we become older.
Part of this madness?
And more worried about, you know, whatever worries us. You know, because little kids don't worry too much. You know?
No.
They don't. They're not much to worry about. You know, and you look at kids in terms of their awareness, and you look at them as strong systems. You know, kids, as we become older, we become more acidic in our makeup. We become more acidic in our thinking, if I can say it that way. And
right.
I think that really does take away from our potential. So when we, you know, technology, I think, is closely resembles what sort of we want to reflect in our realities in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Religion and science were once joined. In fact, I participated in a conference on the environment that was environmental scientists as well as theologians and others. And it was done by the Orthodox, actually put on by the Orthodox, which trace their, you know, roots back to the island of Patmos and the revelation of John and the split from the Catholics in 1054. Well, this group looked at science from a different perspective, put together a conference, brought in all kinds of people. And what they said is, you know, maybe they shouldn't have split, you know, back in the Middle Ages. Maybe
right.
there was room for ethics and values as expressed through religious thinking in terms of science. A little out of whack back then, but again, you know, thinking about when do you put the ethics sort of back in the science, especially when science has the ability to do the kinds of things that we can do today. And that's the challenge, I think, for this generation. As we look at the last 15 years of work in reporting on technology and science, and some of our writing has been sort of a warning, hey, this stuff is coming, and others have been, well, now it's too late. You know, certain things have already happened. And
when did it get here?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and Earth Rising 2 was about that. Because it was post 9/11. You know, 9/11 happened, and then a lot of the things that we saw coming that we'd written about in 2000, and Earth Rising the Revolution, actually did happen. And as we see this thing sort of advancing, it's not retreating fast enough. You know, we expected this administration to do some things different. And I think this administration has recognized the fact that systemically it has to change. And until it does, we will not see the kind of wholesale changes that need to be made. Because incremental changes aren't going to do it.
Right.
In the same way that they used to. The system has become rotten.
Right. To the core. And yes, you can't. I mean, it's like trying to put something new on top of a surface that, I mean, you know, the foundation that's falling apart, that's just rotting.
Yeah. And I think we're, you know, when we see the Congress sort of leaving, you know, the Senate, I've got 11 senators now from both parties, 5 Democrats, 6 Republicans, said we're not running again, which is extremely rare to have happen. But what they're voicing is, many of them, and are voicing this frustration of not being able to legislate and govern, because what they're really doing is pandering to special interest, and they're sick of it. People that really are true leaders, committed public servants from both parties, are giving up. And some of them are giving up because they also see the handwriting on the wall, the odds of an incumbent winning the next cycle, I don't care where they
right.
been, is getting smaller and smaller, because people are sick of the status quo and the direction in which our country has not been drifting, but has been directed, and in a direction that most of us find distasteful for lots of different reasons. And I think we're going to see that kind of change take place politically. Hopefully, it makes its way through the rest of our society, because reform is on the horizon. And sometimes, you know, that we started the show with the discussion of natural disasters in Haiti, and you know, I can tell you that when you're already down as low as Haiti was, to go down any further is difficult to conceive. But the rest of us are one disaster away.
Right.
And you know, when you start to think about it, and the further up our society is, the more dependent on technology it is, the further the fall when you hit the ground.
And that was, go ahead.
And I think that's the other side of this thing is, the humanness of our technologies needs to come back into focus, and what we do with them and how we progress the planet, the technology we've researched and looked at and the things that are out there to truly transform the planet into a system that can sustain the life that's on it in a much better way, and not in some retrograde way, but using our science to advance our societies in ways that are more prudent. And that requires a redirection from so much of our productive wealth to military science and development based on fear, because that's the job of military.
Right.
Needs to change. And much of our research needs to be driven by other ways of thinking.
Absolutely. And you mentioned bringing back the more humanistic aspect in terms of technology. And my question I was going to focus on or bring to you is, would you say the conveniences, this is what I'm seeing, and I've said this for years, I've seen it gradually moving in that direction, but we're a society that has become dependent on conveniences, and technology is certainly bringing conveniences, and I'm not saying that we throw out all of the conveniences, but what I'm looking at is the manner in which it starts to slow down one's ability to become more brain active, if I can use that, if I can state it that way. But I think you know what I mean. But
yeah, I think that's fair. Just the idea that, you know, I mean, we become so dependent on so many externals that really, when we look at what is really important, sort of assessing all that, you know, a lot of what we think is so important truly isn't. And when we discover it is usually in bad times. and what we really find important are the last things that we really think too much about. But I think the tough times the country's facing right now and the direction that we're in right now is causing a lot of people to reflect differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I look at where does our work go in the next 15 years,
right.
I'm less inclined to research and continue to talk about sort of the bad news as much
right.
as I'm more inclined to research and look at the ways in which...
What can we do about it?
What are people doing that are progressive and positive,
right.
that are resulting in good changes? And I think if we each focus a little bit more time on that, I think we'll be much better served by it. And there's lots of what we can do. It's giving up is the worst. Being fearful,
right.
of course, runs right in line with that. And I think at some point the balance tilts and a new direction is possible. A lot of people hoped that this administration would bring that, and I think they're stymied by the same thing that any administration would be stymied by, whether you agree with them or not, and it's the fact that there's no honest debate, there's no honest discussion, there's no really full disclosure. It's the sausage factory of special interest, and that's pretty dramatic. I, when I was back east, I went to visit a lobbyist, and I'm thinking I'm going to go meet this guy in his office. So I went to this building, and it's 16 floors tall.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Where's the office?" And you're standing in it. You know, the whole building is that one office. You know, and it's 16 floors of lawyers. You know, and you're going, good grief. You know, and it's one firm out of thousands. You know, maybe dozens
yeah.
on that scale, and hundreds on the little lesser scale, and thousands on the lesser scale. And then you wonder why you can't get anything done in D.C.
Right.
Well, you don't have a 16-story office building full of lawyers talking your stuff for you.
Oh my gosh! Even working, you know, and you think about that, and I keep looking for that moment when that becomes more common for people to begin to work more from, you know, from their homes. There's so many things now that people can do from their homes and spend more time with their families. And I've seen that over the years, it's got progressively, more intense in terms of people not spending enough time, families not spending enough time together. There's not enough time in the evenings to spend together with your children and the weekends. You know, you don't spend that much time with your family when you work.
No, and the actually it's gone, it used to be, and you stop and think about this, and you ask about technology and change. The anticipation in the 60s was that we would be in a leisure society by now, that these technologies would serve us in a way to free up more time and the work week would get shorter, and just the opposite.
Yeah, it's just the opposite.
Now it takes two and a half jobs to support a household, if you're lucky enough to have them. And it used to be one job within any number of trades was sufficient to not only support you well, but you could expect
support a family
and put kids through college and support a family and do those things. And you can't now. And so, again, you know, what's important and where's the focus been? If we had spent as much money or even half as much money on looking at improving agriculture and energy and things that are relevant to average people, as opposed to building better weapon systems, what could we have achieved? And,
right.
and that's where I think the challenge is for this generation, is to say, okay, we do need strong militaries. The world is still an unstable place. But at what point do we start to recognize that there's a limit and what's really needed in a 21st century scenario? This country, if it does not alter its course, you know, manufacturing base is not going to come back. The kind of jobs that used to be here, the likelihood of them coming back are pretty slim.
Right.
That means this economy is not going to get better. It's going to get worse. Well, at the
right.
same time, billions of other people can say the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Their lives are improving, even though it may be for the price of a six-pack of beer in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Things are changing globally at a rate that, you know, look at the developing world, you know, double-digit growth. We have since the Industrial Revolution, and it's affecting billions of people, and on the hundreds of millions of people on the Western European U.S. side are seeing declines. So you got to ask, so systemically, what's going to change? What is the U.S. Going to compete with? What is, you know, what are the economies going to look like? More importantly, you know, what are we going to be competitive at? And, you know, looking at where our money's going, you know, it's going in the wrong direction. We got to have great militaries if you want to be the gladiator for the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have an enormous amount predicted to continue to flow into healthcare, and it continues to grow even without additional government expenditures. And if you look at just the whole direction of technology, we should really be saying and asking these questions. You know, where are the limits? What are the right directions?
Mm-hmm.
And to do it, you've got to change the system. And that is the thing that I think ultimately we can talk about symptoms through HARP or through any number of things that we can point the finger at, and they deserve the finger to be pointed at them and, you know, them to be brought into the light of day. But the root of the problem has to do with an ever-growing secrecy syndrome within government,
mm-hmm.
the ability of special interests to control greater and greater portions of government, and hence where the majority of the planet's resources go. We should have had an energy policy that started in 1973 with the first oil embargo that got us to energy independence today on the backdrop of technology, just like we got to the moon when it became an important thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Brazil did. And look at their economy. Double-digit growth predicted for long into the future, a very strong currency, independence in energy production, and a growing economy. That's a pretty outstanding achievement in the 21st century for a third world country. And here we are, a first world nation with huge underemployed intellect, huge underemployed resources, and we can't organize them enough to solve the challenges of the century. And I don't believe that. I think it's the system doesn't allow for it at present, but I think that is in the process of change.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, most of the focus for quite some time now here has been war-related.
Absolutely, and continues to be. I mean, U.S. has 800 bases and stations across the world today. I mean, why do we need the boundaries of the United States? I mean, we can get anywhere in the world in about 12 hours.
Control!
If we're in a real hurry, you can
have
a conventional warhead on an intercontinental ballistic missile and deliver it anywhere pretty quickly. But, you know, why do we need all of this? And what infrastructures are we supporting with this? And if you want to really look at why, look at the lobbying that goes on from the military, industrial, academic complex in Washington, and then you understand it. It's how come we buy billions of dollars worth of planes that the Air Force is using.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we don't even need them. We don't want them.
Exactly. So you see, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and I was saying, you know, again, we have to recognize that countries are business. They're run like a business. And I said, you know, when we look at the U.S. right now, we can refer to it or compare it to a business with bad management. And the business is slowly going down the drain, you know.
Well, the business of government is not business. And that's what people forget, is it's about services that people actually want. And so what is government in this country supposed to deliver in services? Well, postal service, we felt good about that, and we wanted a defense that was workable. But it wasn't a defense that was a standing army at the time. It was one that came up when you needed it, you know. And you were always ready, but you didn't have standing armies. They weren't conceived in the U.S. You brought them up when you needed them. That's changed, I think, in the 21st century. But, you know, the general idea was limited government. And now in government, which was relatively simple. You know, you remember the old stories of Abe Lincoln learning the law by reading a couple of books.
You know,
passed the bar and practiced law, and you could carry the law library under your arm.
Yeah.
Well, now it fills up several folds of any number of big office buildings.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, that's not the law that was envisioned by our founders, that where you could go in front of a jury of your peers and express your discontent with whatever's happened to you, and sensible people could make a sensible ruling.
Operative word there, sensible.
Well, you know, and it was based on the imperfection of it all, you know, I mean, the fact that
it was simpler.
Yeah, so, but it was simpler, and you could actually get justice, and you could get it on your own. Now you can't get justice unless you're wealthy.
Yeah.
You can't get legislation unless you have a big lobbying firm. And you can't reach through the executive. You can, I guess, through the agencies to some degree, but it's pretty limited because it's so complicated. And I think that's where government sort of lost touch with the rest of us and now serves other interests.
And I think, you know, when I was, who was that? Oh, I was on Conscious Media Network and being interviewed on there. And I think the question was, what did I have to say, or what kind of encouragement could I give to people who are, you know, losing jobs and that kind of thing? And you know, I think that, again, this is an opportunity, regardless of how it all seems dismal. I think people have to begin to pull out those opportunities, look at what I can do. You know, if we can go back to the days of when more people worked for themselves, and it doesn't have to be, you know, an office thing. There's so many things that people can implement, but I think, again, we've become very dependent and very programmed to believe that unless we're working for a big corporation, we're not going to make it. Yet those corporations are not secure. They're not stable. People, you've seen thousands of people laid off at any given, you know, moment. Unless you're watching those books, unless you're sitting in there and you see the bank account, there's no such thing. You don't know. So,
right.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. There's a company got a great reputation in the U.S. at one point, you know, for dealing with people and making a bunch of them millionaires as they grew into a company. And they went through a major layoff in the last year. And at the same time they were laying off all those U.S. Workers, they were trying to get 8,000 visas for foreign workers to come in and for a bunch of jobs. because corporations don't have a soul. You know, they don't care about your interest in life. They care about their shareholders' interest. That's the law. They have to. Their fiduciary responsibility is to make as much money as they can for the shareholders.
That's right.
If they do something that doesn't do that, they can get sued.
That's right.
So,
it's not about you.
No, it's not about you. And to expect it to be about you is unrealistic. In fact, I knew one of those employees who got that layoff notice after 17 years of faithful service, and he goes, wow, you know, the company just threw me away, you know, and it's like the realization that hits people is, you know, you're not the valued employee. The valued
that you thought you were.
That you thought you were, and at least in their eyes, and yet, you look at yourself in the mirror and you go, hey, wait a minute, you know, I did good things, I've got good capacity. But that's the attitude is not about you. It's about a corporation.
About making them money. I mean, that's just the bottom line of it. And you get just enough to, keep a roof over your head. For most people, that's what it is. Live a little bit of what the supposed programmed American dream that's been given to people. And you get to live a little bit of that just so you can be content enough to come back to work to do that all over again, but it's really not for you.
I think that's true. I think it's gotten more so that way. And, you know, and yet, you know, again, it's sort of looking at the side of technology that does some things. You know, we're having this conversation in a way that couldn't have happened 25 years.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, and that I think is a phenomenal thing. And the fact that, you know, the next big breakthroughs that I think are again sort of pointing us in another direction is, translation, you know, translation technologies are going to be instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
So we can have this conversation in English and have a simulcast in 50 or 60 other languages at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That is not so far away. And
yeah.
The ability of people to have real-time communications, even when they don't speak the same language.
That's awesome.
That's that is going to be phenomenal.
That's going to be awesome.
Because in all the areas of the arts and sciences and thinking, open up to broader and broader venues. And the ability to control that, see, this is the other exciting news, is the ability of controlling information is becoming less and less possible. And if people look at information in a different way, you know, what's important for the public to have to make sure the wrong guy doesn't get it? You know?
Right,
I mean,
right.
If you think about the best alternatives in energy are the ones that are going to be open source licensing, or they're going to be licensed in a way that's different than what it is today, so people can get the technologies, you know, into development. And I think that's kind of exciting, because now you look at the systems, and people who are inventive and creative look at the system and say, hey, you know, who's going to block my play? Who's going
right.
to stop moving forward?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're approaching it differently, and there's different avenues to bring things forward. And so I think we're going to see in our lifetimes, if we're blessed to live so long, the next 20, 25 years are going to be the threshold years of
amazing changes. Amazing changes.
And it'll be rough in some spots and
mm-hmm.
elegant in others. But at the
mm-hmm.
end of the day, I think what we're going to see is the application of technologies in perhaps a much different way. And I think to get there, the abuse has to be better recognized. And, you know, I think that's part of the information process. And it takes time, but I think it's happening. I think people are spending more time sort of reflecting on what is important. As a consequence, I think we're going to get there.
And, you know, I was so excited, you know, yesterday I got, my internet got finally connected because, you know, I had just moved, but now I have fiber optics and it moves so fast. I'm just,
yeah.
you know, so that in itself is another amazing thing to me. You know, what is it? It's information, what's stored or was it a piece of glass or reflected through a piece of glass, but however they did it, information broken down to what, light?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just in terms of just technological change, making that loop. You know, I mean, we were running on phone lines at the rates that were just nothing, and people couldn't even fathom.
Dial up.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the options that are available to us and, you know, video interactions, you know, that's going to be the next big thing. People are talking about it. It's going
yes.
to be even more than it is now. I think that's a good advancement. I think our communication should be even more personal than that, but it's a good advancement. But again, you know, when we start to look at all of it, I think it's great times that we're in. The emerging nations at the same time have the ability to maybe do things differently. I mean, if you think about having no infrastructure and then having the opportunity to choose
right.
and maybe some other options on the table, I think that's, again, where we're going to see some breakthroughs. Places like China that need energy resources might end up being the engineers that actually break out the transforming energy sources that really change the planet. And, you know, what does it take? You know, but one significant invention in any number of areas can totally transform everything about the rest. And I think that's this generation's charge, if you will. I think that's our challenge as well.
Weren't they working on, you know, I just thought about the device we talked about earlier, the machines in the airports in terms of being able to basically see through your clothes, you know, because I saw one of those. And I just thought about it, you know, aren't they working on teleportation machines, you know, for, I read that some long time ago, and this wasn't made up stuff. This was real.
Yeah, I think there's been interest in that, certainly. I don't know what the research is. It's not something that I've really looked that much at. But, you know, when you look at all of that sort of far-out technologies, you know, the things that we do routinely today 50, 60 years ago would have been just fantasy. You know, so what becomes reality, I think we have a lot more left to see. And
we won't need the planes anymore.
You know, think about just transport in general. You know, we start to look at other fuel sources and other ways to move things around. I think all that's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Just if you take energy as part of the equation, if we can reduce the cost of energy, which is the direction
yes.
to to get it to be a lower and lower cost item as it affects our general economy, that's where a fundamental change. If you take energy out of the picture and make it relatively inexpensive, man, then things like refrigeration, distribution, a lot of bigger problems end up being solved that seem unrelated but are totally dependent on energy costs. And you look at developing nations and the cost of energy. Look at sophisticated countries like ours that have a balance of trade that's 50% of it is related to energy imports. That maybe there's alternatives that will free us from that, and I believe there are. Those are big things. That frees up a lot of money to be
spent. That's true.
Other more positive and powerful directions.
Right. And, okay, well, we're getting basically there. We ended up going longer, but it's just been so fascinating. But before we go, I'd like to also have you just talk a little bit about the cell phones, because we've certainly stepped it up in terms of the cell phones, what we now have, these little computers, and how that affects us. Are they more intense on our brains at this time, on our bodies, as opposed to before? Or, I mean, where are we with this right now?
Well, I think the cell phones, as they get more and more packed with electronics, the handling of the energy becomes increasingly important, and so they tend to be the effort is to save energy and create the minimal discharges. Yet we're surrounded. We put the cell phone next to the head. We transfer heat immediately into the head. There have been a number of studies on this. The newer phones are a little better than the first generation by far. By now, most people have transitioned their phones to phones that handle energy fairly well, but they're still create a number of radiation dangers. In fact, in Earth Rising 2, we dedicated a chapter to cell phone safety, and we have some great stuff on our website on cell phone issues that were published back in the late 90s, maybe early 2001, maybe 2002.
Mm-hmm.
We have some articles. Nothing has significantly changed there except proliferation. I've heard recently now 5 billion cell phones exist on the planet. You know, in emerging economies,
wow,
the preferred tool. They don't hardwire phone lines. They get the cell phones or cheaper and the infrastructure is less costly. But when you think about placing the device next to the head, the things that are reported are, heating behind the ears is often reported, interference with sleep patterns, eating habits, sex drive are reported, confusion is reported, short-term memory interference, quite a bit, enough to be concerned, as well as tumor formation has been attributed to cell phones, and that is probably the sleeping giant, because it's a cumulative effect over time and use. So when you're using a phone, 5 minutes a week versus 5 hours a day, there's going to be a significant difference in terms of what's going on inside the body. But the heat transfer is thought to be the mechanism for breaking down the blood-brain barrier, which allows the formation of tumors within the brain. And that's been something that has been very controversial. You'll see the industry saying no worries. At the same time, greater segment of the scientific community are pointing out earlier studies where the same energy and frequency ranges were studied and tumor formation was a result.
It's amazing. There's still a lot of people who aren't aware of the effects of these phones. As I see people stick, I've seen women with the phones in their bosom next to their skin.
They're just transferring the problem around. The real solution is cell phones aren't going away, so speaker phones to keep them away from the head are ideal,
and then
putting the phone away from the body when you're storing it is a wiser move. Minimize usage in cars because they use a lot more power to broadcast out of the cage of a car in big structural buildings, and the key is try and minimize use. You know, I mean, a cell phone, my family, we have one that I use when I travel.
Mm-hmm.
$10 type of number.
Right, right.
And that's it. You know, and otherwise, yeah. I don't use them. People say, what's your cell number? I don't have one, you know, because to me, it's not a necessary.
It's for emergencies only.
Yeah, and that's where I always looked at it. You know, and if you need to spend time on a phone, you do it on a landline.
Right.
It's healthier. It makes sense. You won't get a car wreck, too.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's good reasons. Some people think that everything is instantaneous. In my life, I've at least found that most things are not emergencies. They
can right.
And there's something to be said for having the freedom of actually paying for your phone and deciding when you're going to use it.
That's true.
You know, I've seen people whose entire life revolves around the telephone, and I think that's unfortunate.
Well, that's true, because when the cell phones came in, suddenly, I've even seen that with myself, suddenly everything was important, and I needed to make that call right then.
It really doesn't.
I
think it's, again, you know, we were talking about this earlier. You get all these conveniences, and they're great, but where do you draw your own lines? And I think we start drawing our lines sometimes because our economy dictates it, and others because we start thinking about, well, what is this really doing to my quality of life?
Absolutely.
Is it what I want my life to look like? And Facebook, another phenomenon. You know,
yeah. Spending
hours and hours interacting with other people on a computer instead of going and meeting someone, you know.
It's so much work. I mean, I use it. It's great for marketing because you just quite a few people if you want to send something out. But the people that I see on there sending a message about nothing out every few, sometimes it's several times a day, and I'm thinking,
yeah.
Where do you work? Where do you find the time?
Where do you find the time
to do this? You know, and it's like, oh, that's just, I mean, too much. It's just too much. But you know, hey.
But it's the nature of this, you know, this time that we're in. So things are changing fast, and there's a lot of possibilities, and it's interesting, and you know, and kids communicate differently. I mean, obviously, it's even in terms of multi-generationally, you look back and, man, you know, it used to be a letter and it'd take you a week.
Exactly. And kids.
I didn't call anywhere in the world for it.
Right. Well, my, in terms of kids and Facebook, I know my older son, my grandson, who I think he'll be 9 this year, and he's forbidden to have Facebook. he's not allowed to have Facebook, and I think his mom had got him signed up on Facebook, and that didn't go over very well.
No,
so
I mean,
allowed to use it.
It's just our challenges for, I guess, this next generation. Well, Sonia, kind of wandered off about
this
a little bit, but you know, this is important because I think behind all of the technologies ultimately are, you know, what do we think about them and where we're headed?
They all come together. You know, they're all somehow connected, as you say, in terms of where we're going. But I certainly would like to thank you for being on the show. And if you would please give out your website again and whatever information you want to give out.
Well, check out our website at EarthPulse, EARTHPULSE, EarthPulse.com. We have a lot of information there, books, videos. That's how we continue to do this work. And check out our books. When you're done with them, send them to policymakers. Put them in your library. Get them out there where people can see them, and we certainly appreciate that when that happens. Again, that's EarthPulse, EARTHPULSE, EarthPulse.com.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much. It's definitely a pleasure, as always, to talk to you, to hear you on even other shows. So I'm looking forward to our next time. Thank you, Dr. Nick. To the listening audience, thank you for joining me for another enlightening and intriguing hour and a half, almost 2 hours, actually. Be sure to subscribe to the website, Sovereign Mind Radio, of course, sovereignmindradio.com, to listen to the archive. And, of course, remember that the power to be a sovereign mind, a free mind, lies within you. Join me.